Let me concretize it with something that I didn't know in specific at the time I made my own gut reaction to what was the 3rd and 11th September 2001. And let me make it reasonably local, although you have to go across the bay climate. There may be counterparts here for all I know. There's lots I don't know. But in the financial district, I'll say San Francisco, I believe you understand by two individuals who just happened to walk in, and they just happened to be my students, who just happened to be on spring break, and therefore were out here. I mean, put that within clause in the Bay Area. If it's BART, transportation from the airport to get downtown, that puts it in the financial district. Those of you familiar more than I don't know roughly where the BART stations are in the financial district of San Francisco. They would be met and get a ride, so when they emerged from the BART station, they had some time to feel before the ride was set to show up. They went into a bar for a beer. Now this is the locale. These are the facilities in which what I would call this technocratic elite, this core of empire, would go in their off hours after work like anybody else, and have their beer to socialize, to chit-chat, to strategize what it is they're going to do to maximize profits and make paid business and get themselves ahead. And I was originally given an understanding erroneous that the name of the place was something like 40 Indians. It turned out it's something or other yesteryear. It's going to be within view of the water station down there. I don't see too many people here that I'm expecting initially the financial history, but you can probably find it on these instructions. And the 40 Indians went to the core of the place, which in the first instance has to do with 40 Indian motorcycles that are mostly hanging from the ceiling, so you look up at the undercarriage of the bike. So because if you're a bike aficionado and you want to invest in these sorts of things, these will probably be a significant interest to you. But the owner collects things under the motorcycle, collects memorabilia of what's called the Indian Wars. And so he's got a guy on from the 10th Cavalry, he's got a saber from some Northern officer like Ronald McKenzie, he's got all the horses, he cuts for his spurs, and in a display case, he's got something else. The placard that explains this little handful of human teeth says that they are the teeth of Custer's law, knocked out as he disciplines her. Now, I don't know whether these are Marlon Seeker's teeth or not. Doesn't matter. He's claiming that they are. A young woman out of her black table, after her father was killed in Custer's onslaught and massacre of the peace camp at the Wausau River in 1868, he did in fact take her as a captive, forced her into sexual concubinage for a period of years. He got children with her until he was tired of her and cast her off. This great American hero. The person revered in Orthodox historiography. The individual military figure most written about of any in the United States history. That says something to social sensibility. This is who is David here, and Matthew is of course himself in this fashion. But the question then becomes, what kind of a twisted mentality would collect as a family heirloom of body parts removed violently or imposing sexual domination on a captive all around skin other. And that goes to the sensibility of the owner of the bar. But most importantly, what kind of mentality imbues the clientele that wanders in and has recreation and social life, enjoys itself, is relaxed and comfortable in the presence of this kind of trophy, this kind of display. You can take your own word. Mine is heightened. Mine is heightened. It's in the world as a whole. And that's what it is. I drew that conclusion. And I frame it out and allow people to draw a series of conclusions off that. I don't make them for you. I have my own set of conclusions drawn from the evidence as it presents itself to me. And I'm made that clear. And the object for the reader is to arrive at equal clarity, although that clarity may be different from my own. That was an issue. That was the outrage. I can consider through other aspects through the essays that are more problematic for those who are using the item phrase as their lightning rod, things like saying the solution to what is presented as a problem, and that kind of a phrase that goes something like compliance with the United States government with the rule of law. That's what they find most problematic and can't even respond to. But irrespective of that, that's interpreted. The statement is the issue. And as a result of the statement and Bill O'Reilly converting his program into the worst triple factor for the last 60 days, I've had two governors, one state legislature, my home board of regents, all of me to be summarily removed from my position. And this is an institution which has one of the most elegantly framed articulations and implications of academic freedom that I've ever encountered. I mean, rhetorically, it's beautiful. It should be taught in literature classes. And there's a lesson that I think is embodied in that for all of us, given the nature of the response. The response to the person, the statement became an issue. And that is that articulation of the principle of academic freedom fitting into titles within the legal principle articulated in the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States was absolutely, unequivocally advanced, indeed sacrosanct, right up to the point where it was hit. The moment it actually had to be defended, they not only walked away from it, they turned and ran. How will your regions, how will your government, how will your political lobby in the state of California respond in similar circumstances, especially that might be in some moment, too? There is absolutely no basis in the articulated rules of regents of the University of Colorado to undertake an investigation to effect censure or to take any other action against any faculty member, actually with or without tenure, based upon the content of speech. The immediate response was, one, to condemn what was said in an official way. There's no basis for that either. The individuals who engaged in condemnation, of course, are entirely entitled to do so as citizens, as individuals, as academics even, but not as representatives in official capacity of the University of Colorado. But not only condemned it, but then initiated what they said would be a 30-day investigation of my statements. That one, others made verbally, and the entire purpose of my work to find out whether I had transgressed the boundaries, speech boundaries, implied within the rubric of academic freedom. Now, let me explain the formulation of this, because it's usually taken for granted that the meaning of academic freedom, the language that ensures that within each institution, which contracts and tenures, faculty members, is thought to be self-evident, it's not so much. There's a conflation between First Amendment and academic freedom. So let me make the clarification here of what's really at issue. When they instigate an investigation on this ground. That is that under the First Amendment, the rubric of that, all citizens and otherwise non-citizens as well, residents in the area known as the United States of America, are imbued with prerogative to express their point of view how and when they like. That's expression of opinion is not itself sanctionable, censorable in any way. Well, we know that's not true. There is passing post-right, Latin speech, so it's not absolute, but that's the general principle involved. But then you get to academic freedom. Individuals within the academy are, of course, abused with the same rights as any other citizen. You have a body, you have a right to express yourself, but under that rubric, we articulate the obligation. It is your job to arrive at informed opinion and state the truth in the public discourse as you understand it. If you were not doing that, you were not doing your job. So in effect, I was sitting under investigation. You're doing exactly what I was hired and contracted to do. This was the situation. It became very problematic, both in constitutional and in terms of response to the academic community, which has been very strong heretofore. And the strength of the response has sort of precipitated a sort of duplicitous maneuver to the side. Some of you may know, last Thursday, they finally, well over 30 days into the investigation, of which I have yet to be officially informed, about which I have yet to be in any sense consulted or asked a given question on a given topic, anything at all. There's been no interchange whatsoever. The report nonetheless is issued, and they discovered, surprise, that there was no basis for action to be taken against me based on the content of my statement, which was self-evident before the fact. In effect, they just said there was no basis to initiate the investigation in the first place, but in the course of the investigation, there were allegations made by other academics, including UC Berkeley's own John Liddell. Oh, he doesn't teach here. He's graduated from Bull Hall. Not long ago. Allegations of plagiarism, misuse of sources, and such as that. They're shifting ground to accomplish the same result, taking it out of the arena of straightforward articulation that is the speech, that is the content of the speech, that is the analysis at issue to which we object. We can't say that, we won't remember what's look stupid, so let's backfill the pretext. So the allegation comes that John Liddell has accused me of plagiarizing several pieces. They've even been identified. Problem is, but when you go to the essay in which John Liddell supposedly accused me of plagiarizing, he did not. He accused me of exactly the opposite. He suggested that I wrote pieces that appeared under other people's names. That is not plagiarism. I don't know exactly what the word would be for it, but essentially I'm being now accused of plagiarizing myself. That's one allegation. I'm also being accused of plagiarizing a speech I did not write, on which my name does not appear. And then the notion was put forth in blog form by an eminent scholar from Lamar University. You do know where that is, right? Thomas Brown, and his yet utterly unpublished assistant professor who is building apparently his first ever to be published piece on parsing one foot code. The entire focus of the work based on a disagreement with interpretation of the main sources. This is brought forward then by the professor who took a Gauss piece and turned it 180 degrees out of page of itself in terms of the conclusion. He wants to make a case and plead for mission of sources. That's stuff of substance that's been put on the table. If you want to talk about it, I'll talk about it more later if need be. And then finally, the really interesting, dangerous one. Am I really an idiot? Have I misrepresented my identity for purposes of personal gain? All the advantages that accrue to taking the role of Fox to play the American Indian on affirmative action, of course. put forth by a guy who was sued the university twice as an American Indian for discrimination against him because he is an Indian. So now let's see how it is. My entire little life, I won't name, if I'm not soon enough. My entire little life I've been discriminated against by the very institution because I'm an Indian. And Churchill has gotten preference because he's an Indian. Which is a preference and privilege on the basis of checking that box and getting discriminated against. Can't be both at the same time, can it? All the benefits and privileges accrued to an American citizen on the basis of saying the box, American Indian. Anybody out there making that argument wants to try to live on an American Indian reservation? Experience all the benefits and privileges that attend that particular ethnicity. It's an absurdity on its face, particularly in an institution in which I have won virtually every award. I'm sure I signed an affirmative action box and immediately debated upon the Senior and Thomas Jefferson Award, the Arts and Sciences Writing Award, and all this. This comes with a church. Yeah, come on. And all this comes with a ton of you. You don't have to do any more. You know. But on the basis of this anorectically thin fabric of nonsense, we have paid a very, very dangerous potential precedent. That your very identity will be parsed and pulled and put to a vote and determined by a committee in the back room of a university. So this is actually the question of my identity being put in terms of research integrity. What is the research content of self-identification or community recognition, or for that matter, enrollment? These questions are not changing, but essentially, it takes the entire academic proposition and makes it contingent in terms of your participation in it upon your appealing to a popular will that is shaped by the media, that is shaped by political forces, that is shaped by the individual that I've always employed. Newt Gingrich, the winner of Joe Scarborough, in the first week of the World Circus situation. And for all intents and purposes, this has been paraphrased, but you can actually probably get this from him as you can see. If you want to see the statement, get it back words, or pull it down in transcript form. This is the kickoff of a national campaign to question the integrity and ultimately bring about the removal of what he mentioned specifically, your ethnic studies programs, women's studies programs, peer studies as a discipline, critical engagement of all kinds. They have a sort of a pecking order. We're going to target based upon our own calculus and perception of weakness versus strength. But ultimately, it is the purge of every voice within the academy and consequently within the discourse of public life in the United States that they consider to be unacceptable or whatever likes they define at any given moment. Unacceptability. And while Gingrich is plainly ethically impaired, there is no reason to believe that on a topic like this he would not be telling the truth. You can, I think, take him at his word. My governor did. My governor was a member of the Lynn Cheney organization to sanitize, sterilize the academy as a whole. But that calls for my job as an active participant in that. That's interlocked with the injury. It's interlocked with the state of oral race. He's had a series, and it's converted me for whatever set of calculations they happen to make in their little book of law of email communications into the test case for whether it can be done. In a sense, then, in a sense, and this is imperfect as well, I'm the first the national campaign to convert the academy into advanced vocab in which critical skills are imparted the longer period of thought there was in strife, to be processed by the faculty that he decided in the workforce under the managerial authority of the administrators to understand the nature of the product to be produced and delivered to the selected government and corporate funders on what his institutional existence is to be really continued. Go ahead, in terms of critical skills impartation, with a sort of ideological indoctrination, a continuation of public education, in which you are very systematically taught what rather than how to think. So that you understand the answers to questions in soundbite form before you ever have an opportunity to oppose them. The exact inverse of the inculcation of critical faculty that allows them to form a citizenry to make decisions. The most overtly anti-democratic impulse conceivable in the framework of the educational mission is actually being pursued. Sure, conceived it, they're in the process of attempting to implement it. And I'm not alone. There were precursors to me, and within that same week, when the statement was made by Ingrid Thomas, our little program, they had already begun to attack Professor William Balam at Boston University in grounds very similar to my own. There are three junior faculty members at Columbia University under comparable attack, except that there's my tenure rather than my tenure revoked, and the list goes on, and it's going to continue to grow. And we need to understand this, all of us collectively, this is not about an individual or a set of individuals, it's about a set of principles that allow the project that we are engaged in, the vocation of our life, that which we take to be meaningful, is to be eradicated. The place for me is on the front end, not after the fact, which means the time, this is right, it's now.